I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Nick Mosby. He leads a progressive council at a perilous time for our city as we confront a public health crisis, an economic downturn, and a continued epidemic of serious and deadly crimes. Mosby has been a vocal critic of Governor Larry Hogan, accusing the governor of, quote, a deliberate pattern of inequity in the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. Mosby has promised to improve the oversight of city contracts by the Board of Estimates, and he's changed the structure and makeup of council committees. The council has passed one bill so far that's been signed into law restricting restaurant delivery fees. We'll talk about the council president's legislative priorities moving forward. Nick Mosby joins me today on Midday after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. So glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. About an hour ago, the Baltimore City Health Department announced what it expects its allocation of coronavirus vaccines will be during the first week in March. This is the first time that the department has felt comfortable predicting what the supply of vaccines will be in advance. In a statement, Health Commissioner Dr. Letitia Geraza outlined how the city's allocation of 3,500 doses will be divided between people who have appointments at Baltimore City Community College, city educators, hospitals that are targeting older adults, and mobile units. My guest today is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Nick Mosby. He's been critical of Governor Larry Hogan and the state's handling of the vaccine rollout. Council President Mosby is one-third of a trio of citywide office holders in City Hall, inaugurated in December, who represent a generational change in Baltimore's leadership. Mayor Brandon Scott and Comptroller Bill Henry have implemented some significant changes to the structure and operation of city government. Nick Mosby has promised to reimagine how the city's legislative branch operates and the scope of what the council will do. We'll take your calls a little bit later in the hour. For now, if you'd like to drop us an email, our address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. Mr. Council President, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
No, thanks for having me on today, Tom.
So I want to begin with this letter that you sent to Governor Hogan on the 2nd of this month, a couple of weeks ago, in which you said that he was essentially responsible for a deliberate pattern of inequity on the distribution of the coronavirus vaccine. So there's a lot of people who want to get the vaccine who can't get it. It's a decentralized, very murky, very random thing for the people who have been lucky enough to get it. But you're accusing the governor of deliberately withholding it from black and brown communities? Is that right?
No, I didn't specifically say Governor Hogan. I said the state of Maryland, that, you know, it was a deliberate and devastating but reversible pattern of inequity, I think was the specific line I used, Tom. And, you know, I say pattern of inequity because this kind of stems back to, if you could recall, almost a year ago, you know, I had to write letters, get on social media, get my colleagues, I believe close to 100 colleagues in Annapolis, to sign on to maybe my third or fourth letter to the governor and to the Maryland Health Department to start releasing data based off of race, ethnicity, as well as zip code. Because what we know, Tom, is through history, when government makes decisions, particularly in the midst of a crisis, in the dark and without data, that it's underserved communities that are in the desperate end of the impact and effectiveness. You know, so what I did not want was in 3 or 4 years, someone to write a white paper or for there to be a study to show how folks in socioeconomically disadvantaged communities were affected at a higher rate. I wanted us to actually have the data so we could utilize the data to develop a plan and a solution. So that's what we did a year ago. And then when we come full circle to now, we've had this life-saving vaccination. Again, the numbers are just as disproportional. And the first rollout of the vaccine, I think African-Americans accounted for about 16% statewide. When we know that African-Americans populate about a third of the state, But we also know the disproportionate effects of this virus, and not just as it relates to folks who the cases, but also the deaths. I mean, in Baltimore City, 69% of the deaths are African Americans. Statewide, about African Americans are almost two times more likely to die from this. So I get what I was saying when I said that this was a devastating, deliberate, but reversible pattern of inequity is saying that we didn't do all we can do as a state of understanding where our most vulnerable residents were and developing solutions to address their needs. The grandmothers of West Baltimore, the 80-year-old woman who does not have access to internet, but is in that 1A category that has those underlying conditions, that is at the age that has problems, you know, developing a solution where she can only go onto your portal to get a vaccination is just not meeting their needs. So I guess the point was we should have identified who our most vulnerable residents are and developed solutions like peer-to-peer engagement, like working with organizational-based solutions to get to those elderly residents who are extremely vulnerable and we've seen have died at a disparate amount associated with this virus.
And I don't think anybody would question the fact that you were very instrumental in egging on the state government to start collecting racial data. I spoke to a senior person at the health department this morning about how they are collecting data. And if you look at the dashboard for the city and the vaccination dashboard that the city health department has set up, we see 5.6% of Black residents of the city, the percentage of Baltimore City population who has been vaccinated. About 15% are white and almost 21% are Asian. So the data, when I spoke to this health official, it's clear that the data is not complete, first of all, and it's difficult to assemble. I mean, when it comes to the deaths from COVID, we know exactly what that data is because obviously when someone passes away, we know the race and ethnicity of that person. But when it comes to who's getting vaccinated, on the dashboard, they have to rely, for example, on self-reporting. People often don't fill in the part about what their race is or their ethnicity is. And the forms from one jurisdiction to another are different because, again, we don't have a centralized way of doing this. And you can have an argument about whether that should happen or not. The governor says it shouldn't. But do you trust, do you know, do you feel confident that there is data that you know that is showing unequivocally that African Americans in the city of Baltimore are not being vaccinated at the rates that they want to be and that they should be?
Yeah, I mean, well, the letter was statewide, but specific to Baltimore, definitely. And I think the mayor, as well as the health commissioner, will attest to it. I mean, the council held a hearing because we were so concerned about the vaccinations in Baltimore City. And we went through that data. And yes, they will attest to it. I think the disconnect that you might have on your end, Tom, is not every single vaccination that was given to Baltimore City for Baltimore City residents was administered to Baltimore City residents. You know, sometimes teachers who live in the county, sometimes other healthcare workers who live in the county, sometimes folks drove in because they were able to go into the same portal that we're talking about, was able to get, you know, Baltimore City vaccinations or vaccinations that were assigned to Baltimore City. Obviously, if someone had fit into that 1A or 1B tier group for several different reasons, Baltimore City cannot restrict health access to those individuals. So I think that that's where the disconnect is. There was a significant, I think almost close to like almost 60% went out to folks who were not Baltimore City residents, the actual vaccinations that were given to the city of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other issue because the allocation is controlled by the federal government, that basically the federal government is saying you can't, any jurisdiction can't deny it to anybody who really asks for it. So you, correct, you know, you would hope but, that but, people in the city would stay in the city, but
correct. But really it was up to the state to develop the program. I think you brought up a good point when you said, you know, the governor doesn't feel like we should have a standardized way of collecting data. I disagree. I think that, you know, again, data is the king of everything, particularly in the midst of a crisis when you're trying to solve a solution, particularly a solution of an infectious disease similar to COVID-19. It's really about utilizing that data to going after where our biggest pressure points are. We're literally in an emergency room and we're trying to triage a situation. And you take care of your biggest ailment first, right? So that's why it's really important. I mean, this idea that we proportionally spread the vaccines throughout the state doesn't make sense. This idea that we develop a portal where you have to go online in order to get an appointment does not make sense when we understand and know the people who are being affected by this the most. And there's our seniors. That's our folks that are living in communities with digital equity issues. That's our folks that have issues of transportation and can't necessarily go to the one or two sites. So we have to develop transformative solutions to really meet the needs are if we would want to get ahead of the virus the way that we need to.
Yeah. And the only reason I bring this up is because, and I don't doubt, just to be clear, I don't doubt that the health disparities that have been borne by the people of color and the communities of color in our city and elsewhere are real before COVID-19, and that it would make sense to think that they would continue during COVID-19. But I spoke to a scholar from Columbia University yesterday, a woman named Harriet Washington, who talked about the erosion of medical consent. And it's related to this in that she talked about and you mentioned this in your letter to the governor as well, about this narrative that says African Americans are reluctant to get the vaccine. Yeah. For a variety of reasons. She says there's no data about that. We don't know. And I just wondered if that's the kind of thing that we don't know. And she says she does this kind of thing for a living. She mines the data all the time. If we don't know that, maybe we also don't know with specificity the racial and ethnic mix of the people who are getting the vaccine. I don't know either.
I think we're conflating two different things when you bring those two points. I think what we do know is related to vaccination hesitation, that like with any new medicine or any new vaccination, no matter the race or ethnicity, there's going to be some level of folks who do not want to participate or kind of take it, right? So the idea is that there's this overwhelming majority, be it 70%, be it 80%, be it 90%, we know that not to be the case, right? So whatever percentage is out there of our vulnerable residents that fit inside of whatever race, ethnicity, hesitation data you would like to throw at me, why aren't we targeting going after them if they're in 1A? It was kind of the point. If they're the most vulnerable, they should be and have access, and we should develop the plan around how we get them access as soon as possible. Again, developing a web portal where we're expecting an 80-year-old woman in a place that has digital equity issue, in a place where mass transit is a major problem, and she's our most vulnerable person based off of data, and we don't develop a solution around there, that is no solution that you would take into an emergency room when you're trying to triage an issue, right? So I think that is one issue, but we can't conflate that into the issue of the governor saying, I don't want universal or standardized way of taking the data. That was a big push that I pushed on the governor and on the state almost a year ago to say we should be standardized. And I would go even a step further. I think the federal administration, I think the feds should standardize how we take data, because we understand and know through medicine. And I'm a scientist in my background. I'm an electrical engineer. I enjoy data. Data is kind of how I function and how I'm setting up the council and how I've always governed my legislation and everything. But there is no way in 2021 that we're saying that universal data is a bad way to go, because that's how you develop the best solutions, particularly in the midst of crisis.
We're going to take a break. We'll have more with Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby after that quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday WYPR. And related to what Council President's been talking about, the M&T Bank Stadium mass vaccination site opens today. Governor Hogan happens to be there at this hour, walking around trying to get on television. More than 15,000 appointments have been made at the site so far, according to the state. You can text MD Ready. Just put MD Ready in a text message to the number 898-211. So 898-211, text MD Ready, and they will give you updates on when appointments are available. When they first announced the website for appointments at M&T Bank Stadium, it crashed within the first few hours. So there are a lot of people doing it. And to the council president's point, for people who don't have internet access, there is now a telephone-based support line. So call 1-855-MD-GO-VAX. MD-GO-VAX, V-A-X. And they're open 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week. So they will also try to get you on the list for wherever the next available appointment is. There are 220 providers that are now listed on the government website, the state government website, which is called covidvax.maryland.gov. So those are your options right now. It ain't easy, but it is important that everybody get vaccinated. So give it a try if you can. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday on Politics with two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters from The Washington Post, Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker. Their best-selling book, A Very Stable Genius, Donald Trump's Testing of America, is now available in paperback. I talked with Carol and Phil about a year ago when the hardcover came out. We will check in with them again tomorrow for an update on what's ahead for Mr. Trump and the Republican Party. You will recall that Mr. Trump is scheduled to address CPAC on Sunday, so he's making his return to the public sphere after several weeks of staying relatively quiet. Sunday afternoon, we will talk about what to expect at that address tomorrow with Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Nick Mosby. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So, Mr. Council President, one of the issues that was swirling around you at the time of your inauguration and the inauguration of the council a couple months ago was the proposal that Jack Young, actually the former mayor, made to create 9 new positions for the city council president's office. And you supported that, as far as I recall. What's the status of that? This is something that Mayor Scott did not support. He was concerned about the cost of it at a time that the city's belt has to be tightened. But where do we stand with the structure? You've restructured the committees of the council. How about the office of the city council president? Where does that stand?
Well, what we know is that Baltimore City, its residents, the legislature, the executive branch are at a competitive disadvantage and out of practice with best standards around good governance. And their standards are that, you know, when legislation is proposed, residents, journalists like yourself, have the ability to kind of understand and know the impacts that this legislation will have on city government. In Annapolis, we call them fiscal impact statements. Every other major city legislative body has individuals to actually do that analysis, to understand and know what are the pressure points, what are the unintended consequences, and ultimately, how much this is going to cost the city. The fact that we've operated so long and had legislation that has been proposed and passed with no real objective view associated with its financial impact on the city is just unconscionable. And in a time like this, Tom, where we understand and know the residual economic impact of COVID and what it's going to place on our city and our budget, we know that going to have a scarcity of resources, as well as a tremendous amount of need of our residents. Right now, it is irresponsible not to ensure that we have that level of oversight, and we're having that level of communication prior to passing ordinances that will become laws forever. So, we have not gained any significant traction with the administration as it relates to identifying resources to actually do that. We are in ongoing talks and discussions around those things. But look, this is something that not only makes sense from a good governance perspective, but the voters overwhelmingly voted for in the last charter amendments when they provided the equal balance of budgetary power to the legislative branch and the council and the administrative branch and the mayors and the agencies. So somehow that new awesome and right balance, you know, approach to this new role and responsibility of the council is meant with no additional resources to actually do it, no subject matter expertise to do it. I think the one thing that I've constantly talked about, and you see it in the restructuring of the council committees, is professionalizing the council in a way that we haven't seen before. Not just folks that are there to answer calls around filling potholes or boarding up houses, but actually developing substantive solutions to go after the systemic issues that have plagued our city for far too long. And we will not do that in the current structure of the council, but it is my goal and it's my mission to, again, create the most professionalized, the most ready, the most right council to, again, tackle these serious issues in this very, very critical time in our city's history.
City Council President Nick Mosby is my guest. We're talking about the Baltimore City Council and the agenda and priorities moving forward. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to tweet us. It's at midday. WYPR. So, Mr. Council President, for example, there was a bunch of bills around the issue of housing, referred to roughly as, you know, a COVID housing relief package. And they had been progressing through the legislative process, you know, pretty steadily. They got to what's called the third reader, and now they're back in committee. So the brakes appear to have been put on those particular bills. Is this an example of needing, you know, further study or further examination to see what the long-term impacts are? Is this the kind of thing that these extra positions in the City Council President's office would putatively be able to problems that they'd be able to identify and solve before it got this far through the process?
Specific to the housing relief package, which, by the way, really excited about, it's Just Cause, which says that landlords have to provide legal reason to not renew a lease in the midst of this global pandemic as it relates to folks being evicted. It's changes the way late fees are administered, giving folks a 10-day grace period. Most folks, if you have a mortgage, have like a 15-day grace period, and then also providing alternatives to security deposits where we're still keeping the landlord whole, but providing new solutions for that tenant who can't necessarily come up with the first and last month. So no, those bills are still really important. The structure of those bills will still stay intact. I look forward to passing those three bills out quickly. But as it relates to like the financial analysts or the policy analysts, no, that would not change those bills. But there are other bills, like say bills that are creating brand new city agencies or departments and brand new city titles for really important issues. But how much does that really cost the city? And is right now the time to do so? So, you know, I know you've been around the block a couple times, Tom, and you can understand and know when you read legislation sometimes, emotionally, it's right at the right time. But when you look at the data, there are unintended consequences that throw other things off. And when we're dealing with such a tight budget right now, that level of analysis is critically important that we kind of do it. And then when it comes time to budget season, Tom. So right now, the council in 2022 will have the ability of not just cutting money, but also redirecting money, similar to what we passed in Annapolis. So the council is now in a position where either the agency and the folks that came up with this budget will tell us what they want to do with the money, or a nonprofit, an organization, a corporation will now be coming to the council members asking us to redirect money because they disagree with the administration budget. So we will literally be stuck in between a rock and a hard place without any objective oversight or subject matter expertise for us to make the best possible outcomes for the city as it relates to us as a legislative body. So that's why those jobs, that's why that level of expertise again, which is consistent to every other major city in America, is needed in Baltimore City now more than ever.
Yeah, let me just make sure that listeners are clear on the status of these COVID housing relief bills. You mentioned the Just Cause bill. There's an eviction moratorium, but landlords were using the expiration of a lease as an excuse to evict somebody if they haven't paid their rent because they've been unable to because of COVID-19. So you mentioned that kind of thing, the alternatives to security deposits. When do you expect they're back in committee now? Do you expect that they're going to be there for a while? I mean, what is the point of them being back in committee? What are you hoping to achieve?
So the idea, the expectation is they will be coming out in the month of March. So within the next couple of weeks, the entire package will be coming out of it. Again, as a legislator who has worked in Annapolis and seen how hard it is to get the right bills the right way and how much time, attention is needed on that, I am really pragmatic when it comes to that. And I'm building out a council that is doing that. Again, you know, utilizing data, not utilizing just emotions, but ensuring that we're doing the right things and we're factoring in all parties and all sides to it. So, you know, fundamentally, that'll come out. I think there's some technical tweaks and changes that we wanted to do in some of the bills. You know, we look forward to having this package come out all together, and I'm excited about it.
In addition to professionalizing the council, as you say, you've also been vocal about changing the role and the functionality, if you will, of the Board of Estimates, which you chair, particularly when it comes to oversight of contracts and managing contracts with the city. Talk about the ways that you're hoping to improve that and whether or not in these first couple of months of the administration you've been able to achieve any of those goals.
Yeah, well, you know, the Board of Estimates is literally the people's business. It's the spending board for the city of Baltimore. It's the decisions on how we're going to, again, you know, distribute out the limited amount of resources that we have in this critical time. So, you know, under you know, the past couple of meetings in comparison to the past, you know, we've turned basically 5-minute meetings where it was kind of almost a rubber stamp into 2 and 3 hour long meetings where we're getting into the granular detail of how contracts are administered. You know, again, my background as an electrical engineer, managing multi-million dollar projects and understanding like it from a project management perspective, you know, I think I have a certain level of expertise to ensure, and, you know, how are we getting to Six Sigma? How are we developing solutions of finishing projects on time and at cost? But then also, how are we looking at it as it relates to the distribution of these contracts and ensuring that we're getting the level of diversity that we should have in the city of Baltimore when it comes to minority business enterprises and women-owned business enterprises. So I think for those things of when we're empowering businesses that are located in our city that employ Baltimore City residents that are being provided a certain level of scrutiny of finishing projects on time and at cost, you know, I think that that's how we drive the most efficient and effective use of the limited dollars that we have. And again, that's why those meetings have come from 5-minute or 10-minute meetings to 2 hours and 3 hour long meetings. And they'll continue to do that. I'm excited to work with my partners in progress, particularly as it relates to the mayor and as it relates to the comptroller. I think that they've been on board. We're already looking at things of providing a higher level of transparency in the way that the agendas come out. I just don't want to know, like, what are we doing right now for this particular bid? But, you know, over the lifespan of the bid, how much has the city paid out? You know, what have been all the different engineering change orders associated with this bid? What percentage of the bid has been spent? How much contingency money has been spent? So really laying it out. But I think, Tom, one thing that I've constantly pushed is really trying to drive a more centralized project management office where we have specialized PMPs that sit there and are able to manage these projects, these large projects. I don't know if we say over 5 million, 10 million or 25 million, but manage these large projects in a very objective way. When you go to corporations, say like telecommunications companies or energy companies, that's exactly what they do for their larger projects. So in essence, if there's a $10 million project in DPW or a $10 million project in Rex and Parks, this centralized project management office with these qualified trained PMPs would be the one that actually manage that project. And that's how you finish projects on time and at cost. And in a lifespan of what we're paying to build up that resource, the city will save millions upon millions of dollars that we've wasted over the past couple of years.
And you're saying that it's better to do that from a centralized office in the city government rather than have the people at DPW oversee the contract that they're going to be the beneficiaries of, or the people at Parks and Recs. I mean, rather than have the individual agencies keep an eye on it, you think it's better to have one office of project management oversight?
Yes, because they have a certain level of skill set where their job is to be project managers. They're not necessarily subject matter expertise of that particular topic. They can always rely on subject matter expertise of that topic, but their job is ensuring that the tasks are being completed, the project is being finished on time and at cost. And that's exactly what they do on a daily basis. And they're specifically trained to do that. That's why the Fortune 500 companies, that's exactly what they do when they have these large scale projects. You can have the best, say, a design engineer in DPW or in Rex and Parks, or just using two city agencies, for example. But that does not necessarily mean that they have that they are subject matter expert in actually finish out a job and being project manager of a particular job. So, yes, that's exactly what I am saying. And this is only coming from me, from my professional experience of managing, $80, $90, $100 million jobs as a project manager with subject matter experts reporting to me and other project managers are reporting to me. And a person who's worked in a centralized PMO, my previous job before going to Annapolis, I helped stand up a centralized PMO for a large energy company. This was a centralized PMO, not just as it relates to the discipline, but also related to all of the spinoff companies that were kind of under their umbrella. And they thought it was so important to kind of have the centralized PMO because it does give you the biggest bang for the buck as it relates to finishing jobs on time and at cost.
Nick Mosby is the president of the Baltimore City Council. Council President Mosby is with us until the top of the hour. When we come back after a quick break, you can join us, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. And here once again is the phone number, the telephone-based support line. If you don't have access to the internet and you need help getting a COVID-19 vaccination appointment, call 1-855-MD-GO-VAX, 855-MD-GO-VAX, 855-MD-GO-VAX. They're open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. 7 days a week. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the president of the Baltimore City Council, Nick Mosby. By the way, a week from today, we will check in again with Baltimore City Mayor Brandon Scott. So I hope you'll join us for Midday with the Mayor next Thursday here on Midday. To join us today with Council President Mosby, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. So, Mr. Council President, violent crime continues to be a almost intractable problem. We have four fewer homicides as of today than we did last year at this time, but actually a few more non-fatal shootings in our city, although there are other indications of crime that have gone down over the past several months. In terms of the legislative body that you oversee, what do you expect will be the role of the council in addressing this continuing problem?
So the role of the council as it relates to our city is really developing solutions to provide better opportunities, better access to resources for the residents of the city of Baltimore. When we talk about housing insecurity, you know, we just talked about the housing relief package. When we talk about food insecurity, when we talk about education, when we talk about access to jobs and local hiring, those are the things that we know work to provide real opportunity for stable communities that reduce violence in the long term. So, you know, one of the biggest things that we already kind of spoke about today, Tom, was, you know, my role on the Board of Estimates. And I'm such a stickler to, you know, some of these sole source contracts for companies that do not reside in the city of Baltimore, that are not hiring Baltimore City residents, as a problem. Not only is it eating away at our tax base, our limited tax base associated with income taxes with those jobs, but also providing real opportunities for folks in our communities to help reduce the issues in the spinoff. We know that crime is not the core issue. We know that crime is a product of underlying issues. And that's exactly what the council is there to do. And I just hate to continue to piggyback on. That's why we need individuals that are literally going out and developing best practices, identifying initiatives and policies that have worked in like-sized cities around this country, and bringing those types of ideas back to our legislative body so we
can
develop.
Give me an example of some of those ideas, if you wouldn't mind. I mean, Mayor Scott was on the record this morning here on WYPR talking about how he's going to be developing a comprehensive crime strategy that, you know, is a holistic approach, as he's talked about and you've talked about for some time now. You know, he was elected in November, so we have November, December, January, and now February is almost gone, and we still don't have this plan. I just wonder what it is we're waiting for. What do you expect to see?
So, Tom, I think I think that that's where the difference is. I think we have an executive branch and a legislative branch, and there is a demarcation of responsibility. You know, I don't think that it's the council's job to develop a competing crime plan around operations.
I wouldn't expect it would compete, but I just wonder, what do you think? What do you think should be in it? I mean, it's got to be effort to alleviate poverty and the root causes that's behind this.
What do I think should be in the mayor's plan about reducing crime?
And in any good plan for crime. I mean, will the council have a specific role? Is there legislation that you're thinking about that would aid and abet an approach to reducing the violent crime?
Well, when we talk about just stuff that we've already done, when we talk about the housing package again, we know that housing insecurity leads to crime. We know that those two are directly connected with one another. So it's that level of sophistication that we need to continue to, you know, look at the data and develop solutions. When we talk about guns that are coming into our city and how they're getting into our city and what type of laws we can do to kind of pass them. When we talk about just providing opportunities to our young folks so that they never touch the criminal justice system, that they don't graduate to crimes of violence. Those are the things that your Baltimore City Council is supposed to be there to do, while supporting the mayor, while supporting the police commissioner in their operational plan of fighting crime.
Let's go to the phones to Melissa, who's calling from Charles Village. Welcome to the show with Council President Mosby.
Hello, Council President Mosby. I had a quick question. You referenced your project management expertise and the need for project managers in city government, and just now you referenced opportunities for young people. So I'm wondering what your position will be on cuts to the BPD in light of the repeated audit findings that they've been ineffective at keeping track of their hours and keeping track of staffing, and the fact that as a district, the city council has only allocated what's required under a maintenance of effort for city schools for years now, and our capital improvement funding for city schools is extremely paltry when compared to neighboring counties. So if you're really invested in project management, can you describe how that project management will extend to the BPD?
That's an excellent question. So I think there's a comparison. I mean, when we look at inflation, money from the city in the past 40 years has significantly increased to go after quote unquote public safety and significantly decrease as it relates to supporting our young folks. And, you know, I think that that is a part of the issue of what you're talking about as it relates to crime. We must invest in our future. So the city of Baltimore and through the new powers associated from a budgetary perspective must do much more in providing funding and resources to our school system, be it our CTE programs, be our after school programs, be it providing just more opportunities directly to our children in need and in access. So, you know, that's something that I've been committed to on the state side. You know, I sat on Ways and Means when we had very, very long debates about Kerwin and ultimately passed a historic bill in Kerwin that the state legislators taken up the governor's veto this year. And as the city council president, I'm going to ensure that there is a huge focus on ensuring that money gets into our classrooms and that the city is more of a partner as it relates to providing those resources to our young folks.
Let's go to the phones again to Donna, who's on the line from Baltimore. Donna, welcome to Midday with Council President Mosby.
Hi, how are you doing today? And how Councilman President Mosby?
How are you doing, Donna?
Pretty good. I had a quick question. I have a concern that there are communities in Baltimore that are very stable, some are mixed, you know, very mixed, and are growing, and they want to get special, or create a special benefits district. And I know in 2017, the General Assembly passed a bill through Joan Carter Conway to allow communities to, newer communities to create a special benefits district. My question is, why hasn't Baltimore, and you may not know this, but I found that Baltimore has not created a criteria to guide communities guide communities and steps on how to create a special benefits district for themselves. I know Anne Arundel County did that. Theirs has been in existence for 20 years. You can go on their website and you can see the criteria on how communities can establish a benefits district. And theirs is wonderfully written. But Baltimore City has nothing. And my question is, what could the city council do in establishing criteria? Because most of the time you will reach out to your council person and they will give you the runaround and say, well, look into it, but you never get an answer. So my question is, what could be done to create guidelines and criteria to establish special benefits district for those communities who want to get who want to pay some extra taxes to get, you know, more street cleaning and more tracks picked up, just like Charles Village and Mount Vernon, Midtown Benefits District, et cetera. And I'll hang up and listen. And thanks so much.
No, Donna, I think that's an excellent point and an excellent question. Right now, it's my understanding, I believe, that it's somewhat administered through the BDC, the Baltimore Development Corporation, the five or six benefit districts that we currently have. But I think what you're asking for is, why not promote the idea of this opportunity more to residents, and why not develop a solution on step-by-step on how you establish and set up a benefits district? I mean, it is a very arduous task. It takes a lot of buy-in from the community, and then ultimate management and sustainability of that organization kind of falls and relies on that community. But I think it's an excellent point and something that I will definitely take back. Again, I think it's interfacing with potentially maybe the Baltimore Development Corporation and Colin Talbert, the president and CEO of that quasi-government entity, to see what we can do to do exactly what you're saying and get the information out to communities. But I absolutely love that idea, and I look forward to following up with you, Donna.
And Mr. Council President, I understand when you talk about the demarcations between those things that you're responsible for as head of the council and what the executive branch of the city is responsible for. But I wonder, I mean, people want government to work. They want government to be effective. And, when you talk about you need to sort of tread lightly or stay away even from suggestions for the mayor's plan for police, what about making it the city's plan? I mean,
no, see,
couldn't Bill Henry, Brandon Scott, and Nick Mosby sit in a room and say, all right, we're the three citywide elected leaders of our city. Let's figure out what the best way of this holistic approach should be to fight crime and homelessness, address poverty, et cetera. I mean, shouldn't there be some sort of coordinated effort among, you know, the top leadership?
110%. I mean, I think that that is very consistent to what I was communicating. I think I used the phrase, Tom, of not developing a conflicting plan to go after violent crime, particularly as it relates to the operational aspects of how that plan looks. I think you brought up a point that the mayor's been in for 3 months and you were still waiting on that plan. We get the question all the time, well, where's the council's plan? Well, the council's not going to come up with an operational crime fighting plan. What the council will do is be a partner, and what the comptroller will do is be a partner, and what our state delegation will do is be a partner in supporting our mayor and the police commissioner as it relates to the development and the execution of that plan. So I thought that the question was, what is the council's plan?
I'm sorry. No, I didn't expect a separate plan. I agree with you completely. I think it's not a good idea to have conflicting plans.
You have no idea how often, you know, whether it's myself, whether it's the chair of our, you know, safeties and government operations committee, or just individual council members, you know, what is your plan from a policing perspective in this community or, you know, citywide? And I'm always very quick to say, you know, we have to be partners. You know, I have nothing but a respect for the police commissioner and the challenges that he faces as it relates to reforming the department, as well as going after and fighting violent crime. And I know that the mayor is eager to also get that done. And we're going to be with them step by step and working on that solution. I know that one of the plans that the mayor came up with was reducing the number of micro zones so we can get more emphasis and better targets on where we know crime is taking place based off of stats and data. Again, from a council perspective, what we can do is develop, you know, substantive solutions to really provide opportunities for our young folks to really get to identify ways of reducing recidivism. You know, one of my biggest victories while serving as a city council member was passing the most progressive form of ban the box on this Baltimore City Council. Because we know recidivism is a problem in our city. So those are the types of things, Tom, that I was saying that it's our job to kind of lead that effort of that holistic plan. But no, it takes more than just the citywide electeds. It takes the community members. It takes clergy. It takes the business owners. It's literally that table of folks that have to kind of have different pieces inside of that plan. So I wasn't saying that we shouldn't be part of it. I was just saying that you're not going to get a Nick Mosby, this is how we're going to reduce homicides by 30% next month plan. That's not the mayor's job.
We're on the same page with that. Because again, I wasn't asking for a separate plan, but I was just, you know, asking for some indication that there really is some coordination about it. We got 30 seconds left. Have you had a conversation, speaking of the police commissioner, with Councilman Dorsey about his ongoing social media feud with the head of the FOP, Mike Mancuso, because that puts the commissioner kind of in a bind?
Yeah, well, I mean, I addressed this at the council luncheon on Monday. You know, again, we constantly talk about professionalizing the council in a way that we haven't seen, but there's a certain level of decorum that elected officials have to carry. And, you know, the expectation is we will constantly carry that level of expectation. We will not engage in communication such as that. Now, folks are duly elected. You know, the citizens ultimately put them in that position and ultimately have the ability of taking them out of that position.
We're going to have to leave it there.
Well, you didn't give me much time to talk, Tom.
Yeah, well, that's all the time we got. The computer's about to run the news, whether we want it or not. That's Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby. Thanks for your time, sir, and we will see you the next time. Appreciate
it. Absolutely enjoyed it. Bye.
Coming up next, it's Here and Now. It's After News at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.